Okay, good morning, everybody. Good morning, good morning, good morning. One of our last weeks, not quite the last week, but we're getting closer. So this is Bio 241, and it is May 8th. We're going to finish up cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure today. We've got a couple things to finish up. But let's see, what did we talk about last time that's really important that I don't want you to forget about? Well, when we're looking at this diagram, let's go over the schedule first. Sorry, I want to go over the schedule first always. So, here's the schedule. Today is the 8th, and we're going to finish up cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure. We're probably going to have one lecture on respiratory, one on renal, and one on the diversification system. And today I'm going to put in Blackboard the study guides for the rest of the chapters so that you know what's on the test. Okay. So what's on the test? The test is going to be on 14, 16, 17, 18, and 20, a little bit of 18, a little bit of 20, and that's going to be on May 22nd, and that's a Thursday. So those of you that have lab on Thursday, this is really strange because you're going to have your final exam in here in the morning, starting in the morning, and then you do have labs in the afternoon after the final exam. That's just the way it goes. So I will have your grades for the lecture probably before you even finish the class. So I got to get the grades from the lab instructors before you know what your overall score is going to be. But you might have a pretty good feeling. Next week, you're going to have an extra credit quiz, drawing in lab, and then also the last week, you'll have an extra credit drawing. So even though you're done with the lecture exam, still go to lab to get those extra credit points, right? Plus, you'll have a quiz that day as well. That's just the way it goes when we don't have finals week. All right, so that is the schedule. And so let's talk about something in this chapter, maybe what we've talked about before. Here is a diagram. It's a graph of where we have blood in our body, the different compartments. So we have some blood, about 10% in lungs, less than 10% in heart, about 10% in systemic arteries, and maybe 4% in capillaries. But where do we have most of our blood? In veins. And we said that veins are highly compliant, so when there's a small change in pressure, there's a large change in volume. This also says that this blood in veins is a nice reservoir to support your cardiovascular system. For instance, if you need to maintain blood pressure or if you have blood loss, because these veins can constrict, right? And when these veins constrict, that means that the volume decreases, but where does it go? Right? So if these parts of the pie chart get smaller, there has to be something that gets bigger because we can't just cut out a slice and leave it blank. Right, we got to fill all the way around this pie. So that blood that's in a vein ends up in the systemic circulation or capillaries or heart or lungs. So all of this blood right here in veins is ready to go to work to support these different organs in your body. And as a matter of fact, for instance, if you hemorrhage, if you cut yourself and hemorrhage, then your overall blood is going to, the amount of blood that you have in your body is going to decrease. And, of course, that could be terrible for any of these organs right here, but that can also produce vasoconstriction in veins, and that blood is going to go to these organs to maintain homeostasis up to a point, right? So your cardiovascular system might not even notice that you are hemorrhaging for a long period of time because this blood in veins is going to go to all these organs because of vasoconstriction right here. And then there's going to be a point where no more blood can leave the veins, and that's when we start to feel blood loss in all of these other organs. And that's one of the things that happens when somebody's in shock, right? When their cardiovascular system no longer can maintain homeostasis because all this reserve that's in veins has been used up already by the cardiovascular system. So that's one thing that we looked at. What's another thing that we looked at last time? Another thing. All right, we looked at cardiac output, right? What is cardiac output equal to? You got to be familiar with this. It is the heart rate times the stroke volume, or you could say stroke volume times heart rate. Either way you want to think of it. I usually write stroke volume first, And what's kind of funny about this illustration, it shows that the parasympathetic nervous system only has a chronotropic effect because it only goes to the atrium, doesn't go to the ventricle. But the sympathetic nervous system does innervate the atria as well as the ventricle. So sympathetic stimulation can have a positive chronotropic effect when it affects heart rate, and it also has a positive inotropic effect when it increases contractility of the heart and increases stroke volume. All right, so what happens to cardiac output if stroke volume increases? What happens to cardiac output when stroke volume increases? Got to be really familiar with this equation. Since it's directly related, cardiac output increases. And if we increase the rate of the heart, what happens to cardiac output? It increases as well because it's directly related. Right. And remember, cardiac output is a flow. It's a volume per time. It's not speed. It's not a distance per time. So if I look at some other things, probably the other most important thing for you to realize in what we've talked about so far is the Frank-Starling law of the heart, which just says that under normal conditions, when the heart starts to dilate, when it dilates because end diastolic volume is greater, the heart gets stronger. Right? So here we can see stroke volume, which is a measure of contractility or strength of the heart. As the end diastolic volume increases, the heart gets stronger and stronger. And that makes perfect sense, right? When the heart is presented with more work to do, it gets stronger so it can perform that work. The unfortunate thing is, for instance, if someone does hemorrhage and we have less blood volume, less blood going back to an atrium, right, and the atrium stretches less, what happens to strength of the heart under those circumstances where you would like it to be nice and strong when you are hemorrhaging? What happens to the strength of the heart? It decreases, right? That's the Frank-Starling law. And you have to use these concepts all the time in clinical practice. All right, so know something about inotropy, chronotropy, what are positive and negative effectors on the heart, and for sure that Frank-Starling law. Okay. So venous return is very important for maintaining blood pressure because it controls the strength of contraction because it works through end diastolic volume, right? End diastolic volume increases, strength of the heart increases. All right. So let's talk about some other mechanisms that can control heart rate. So we look at the Frank-Starling law. That's just an intrinsic property of the heart. That's intrinsic regulation. Here are some regulatory mechanisms that require organs that are outside of the heart. So this is what we call extrinsic regulation because it comes from outside of the heart. And we see three hormones, antidiuretic hormone, aldosterone, and atrionatriuretic hormone. And when we say natriuretic, all right, what in this class do you know starts with Na? Sodium. Yeah, and that's what this term really means right here. Atrionatriuretic hormone. This is a hormone that's going to work on sodium, and it's going to help put sodium into the urine. That's what natriuretic hormone means, right? So sodium in the urine hormone. Some books might call it peptide, atrionatriuretic peptide, but it's really a hormone, so it's okay with me if you call it a hormone. So after today's lecture, you should be able to tell me which one of these hormones are synergistic with each other and which ones are antagonistic to each other. So would you expect to see some antagonism in these hormones? Yeah, because that's how you maintain balance, right? Precise control and balance is through the mixing of antagonistic mechanisms, including these hormones. The other thing that you should realize is that when we're talking about a hormone will have an effect on the body for a long duration, but it might take a while for it to develop, right? So these effects of hormones may take a while to have some effect on the body, but it will be long-lasting. So it's not for immediate control of blood volume, but it's more for long-term control of blood pressure, like maybe day-to-day or week-to-week or over a period of a month. So that's what these are some things that maintain blood pressure in the long run. And lastly in this chapter, we're going to talk about a mechanism that regulates blood pressure from second to second in your body, but that's not a hormone. What can operate very fast in your body, but for a short duration? What operates very quickly? the nervous system, right? So your heart is also controlled by the nervous system, and we're going to look at that later. But for long-term control, it's going to be a hormone. The first hormone that we have listed right here is antidiuretic hormone. So just in your mind, you should have a good sense of what an antidiuretic hormone does. What does it do? What is it? Yeah, it makes you pee. No. A diuretic makes you pee. Antidiuretic hormone makes you retain fluid, right? So antidiuretic hormone makes you retain fluid. That fluid could go into your cardiovascular system. And so let's just kind of think about a balloon, right? And if we pump air into a balloon, what happens to pressure inside that balloon if we put air into it? The pressure increases, right? And the balloon stretches out. Right, so pretty much the same thing with your cardiovascular system. If we expand the volume by putting water into your blood, then your blood pressure is going to increase. That's just a nice model. But the mechanism you should be aware of, and it has to do with the heart, because when we increase blood volume, we have more blood going back to the heart. The heart is going to stretch, and because of the Frank Starling law, the heart is going to contract with more vigor. Right, and that's really what's responsible for increasing blood pressure. But you could think of that balloon analogy just to get you started in the right direction. Okay, so back to antidiuretic hormone. It puts fluid back in your body, so it's going to have a positive effect on blood pressure. It's going to increase blood pressure. Another name for antidiuretic hormone, or ADH, is vasopressin. And you've got to be aware that people say vasopressin all the time and antidiuretic hormone in the same sentence, and they mean the exact same compound. Vasopressin comes from vaso right here, which means blood vessel. Pressin means pressure. So vasopressin is a compound that increases blood pressure. That's where vasopressin comes from. And we're going to look at two ways that that happens. All right, so where does ADH come from? You know about that already. Right, the pituitary. And remember, pituitary's got two parts. So is it the front part or the back part? Yeah, but we don't talk about it that way. We talk about anterior posterior. So this is a posterior pituitary hormone. And of course, that's sort of a misnomer because it's not really a hormone. What is it? Because it's secreted by a neuron, it is a neural hormone, right? So it's still a hormone because it goes into the blood to a distant target tissue, but it is secreted by a neuron. So it's a neural hormone. What's another neurohormone secreted by the posterior pituitary? Oxytocin. Okay, can you name another one from the posterior pituitary? Nope, that's it, right? So be familiar with that pituitary gland, anterior posterior. So ADH comes from the posterior pituitary. It's released because there are osmolality receptors in the brain, hypothalamus, and these osmoreceptors can sense excess salt or depletion of salt in your body. They can measure salt concentration. And they are stimulated with excess salt or dehydration, right? Because that will increase osmolality. And when that happens, when there's too much salt in your body, you're going to have the sensation of thirst to drink water to bring that concentration of solute back down. And it will also stimulate resorption of water from urine. And that's how this name for this hormone was named, antidiuretic hormone. So let's take a look at a nice feedback mechanism. So we're going to start a response loop with a stimulus always. So the stimulus is a decrease in blood volume or dehydration, right, or salt ingestion. That's going to make the blood very salty as a result. So that increases blood osmolality, but what is that? Is that the saltiness of blood or the unsaltiness of blood when you measure osmolality? How should you think of this? Increase of salt, that's right. So blood gets more salty right here, there's more solutes. All right, the osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus notice that water concentration in your blood is going down or salt concentration is going up. Either one is the same thing. And then the hypothalamus is going to send a signal to the posterior pituitary via that tract, the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, and the posterior pituitary then will release antidiuretic hormone. Antidiuretic hormone, of course, comes from those cell bodies in the hypothalamus. They're just released in the posterior pituitary. Antidiuretic hormone goes everywhere in the body, and it can affect various organs in the body if they have what? if they have what? If they have a receptor, right? And it just so happens that the kidneys do have receptors for antidiuretic hormone, and it's going to tell the kidneys to resorb water from filtrate. That is the first product that the kidney makes, which is not lost from your body, but if it stays within the kidney tubules, then it ends up in urine. So when we say water retention by the kidneys, then we're resorbing water out of the filtrates and putting it back into the blood. All right, so when we take water out of filtrate, or one way to think about it is from the urine, what happens to blood volume? If we take fluid that's going to be in your urine, put it back into your body, back into the cardiovascular system, what happens to blood volume? It increases, right? Okay. And because we're putting water back in blood, then the osmolality decreases. There's less solute because there's now more solvent. And so compare this to the initial stimulus. The initial stimulus was increased blood osmolality. The response is decreased blood osmolality. What's happening here? Are these things adding together or are they subtracting? They're subtracting. So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism that maintains homeostasis. The other thing that happens, one of the other thing that happens with vasopressin, since the hypothalamus is right there in the central nervous system, it will give you the sensation of thirst, and hopefully there'll be some water around that you can drink. And when you absorb water from your digestive tract, it goes into the blood. And what does that do to blood volume? That increases blood volume as well. And it decreases the salt concentration. Again, both of these things are subtract from the initial stimulus. So again, this also maintains a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, so remember, when you put volume, some kind of volume of fluid into a container that's closed, the pressure is going to increase. That's one way of thinking about it, whether through drinking or resorption of fluids from the kidneys. Okay, the other thing that vasopressin does is that it causes constriction. So we look at this pie chart over here, causes vasoconstriction. It can take blood that's in a vein and put it into the systemic circulation. All right, so that also increases blood pressure. That's another mechanism. So increasing blood volume by vasoconstriction is another way of increasing blood pressure. And even by increasing resistance, that increases blood pressure. So when an artery constricts, the resistance increases, and that increases blood pressure. We're going to derive that equation on the board in just a minute. Okay, so that's antidiuretic hormone. What's another name for antidiuretic hormone? Yeah, vasopressin. Okay, what's the overall effect of antidiuretic hormone on your body? Okay, somebody's walking down the hallway and they give you a shot of ADH. What's going to happen to you? After you smack them, your blood pressure is going to do what? It's going to go up. Yeah, because you're going to be resorbing water from urine. That increases blood volume. That increases end-diastolic volume. That increases the strength of contraction. And so blood pressure increases. And that's a hormone that regulates blood pressure in the long term. Here is another hormone, aldosterone. And you should know where it comes from. It comes from the adrenal gland. But what part of the adrenal gland? The cortex, adrenal cortex. Right? And the hormone that causes the synthesis and secretion of aldosterone is adrenal corticotropic hormone. And maybe we're going to look at something else too in just a little bit. So aldosterone, just like antidiuretic hormone, helps maintain blood volume. And if it keeps blood volume or constant, or if it increases blood volume, what happens to blood pressure? It does not go down. It certainly stays the same, or it increases, right? So antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone, how would you talk about the effects of aldosterone and antidiuretic hormone? Yeah, they are synergistic to each other because they pretty much do the same thing. Okay, so aldosterone causes resorption and retention of salt in the body and water from urine, and that's pretty much what we looked at for antidiuretic hormone. It is stimulated by salt deprivation, right? Low blood volume and low blood pressure. That's what helps cause the secretion of aldosterone. And aldosterone participates in this mechanism right here, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system or mechanism. And this is a really super important mechanism for you to become really familiar with, because this is the most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure in the long term. Not short term, but in the long term, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism is by far the most important. So when there is a salt deficit, low blood volume, oh, what happens to pressure when your blood volume is low? What happens to blood pressure? It's low. When blood volume is low, blood pressure is low. So when there's a salt deficit, low blood volume, or low blood pressure, which is almost the same thing as saying low blood volume, angiotensin II is produced. So angiotensin II is another hormone. It causes a number of effects in the body, and the whole purpose of that is to increase blood pressure. Right? So renin-angiotensin-aldosterone is there to maintain blood pressure. And it can do that by vasoconstricting. All right, so when we vasoconstrict that balloon, what happens to pressure? It increases, right? So that's one way you could think of that. Vasoconstriction causes increase in blood pressure. Angiotensin II causes the release of aldosterone, which we talked about on the previous slide, and angiotensin II also gives you the sensation of thirst. Right? And we're going to see that all of these things right here maintain homeostasis in blood pressure in your body. So here is that renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. The stimulus is on the top, and then we see the response over here. And let's just look through this. So the stimulus is low blood pressure and low blood flow to the kidneys. As a response, there's a part of the kidneys called the juxtaglomerular apparatus that can sense this decreased blood pressure and flow. And the kidneys then are going to release an enzyme, and that enzyme is called renin, into the blood. So renin is not a hormone, right? It's an enzyme, so it's going to convert something into something else. And what it does, it converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. What can you tell me about angiotensinogen? It's inactive, right? Because of the ogen at the end of the word, so it's a precursor, but it's in your blood, ready to go to work at a moment's notice, right? And what's going to tell angiotensin to become active is renin. And renin comes from the kidney when it measures a decrease in blood pressure or blood flow. All right, so now we have angiotensin 1. Angiotensin 1 is not the most powerful form of angiotensin. It's, again, sort of a precursor. The most powerful form is angiotensin 2. So angiotensin 1 has to be converted into angiotensin 2 by another enzyme that typically we just call ACE, but it is angiotensin-converting enzyme. We find that mostly in the lungs. This is strange that the kidney and lungs are working together, right? But so we're talking about organ systems all the time. Angiotensin 2 has a number of effects. The first effect it causes, vasoconstriction of arterioles. So again, if you squeeze on something, what happens to pressure? It increases, right? So that's one way to just immediately memorize that sort of intuitively. Vasoconstriction causes increased blood pressure. We need to expound upon that a little bit later today, but that's a good place to start, right? Angiotensin 2 goes to the adrenal cortex, and guess what? It causes the release of aldosterone. And aldosterone causes salt and water retention by the kidneys. And if we increase blood volume, oh, here's blood volume. So blood volume does increase because we're not losing water in urine. When blood volume increases, again, what happens to blood pressure? It increases, right? So what do these responses, how does it compare to the initial stimulus? They're opposite. They subtract from each other. Right, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining blood pressure homeostasis. Okay, so I don't see antidiuretic hormone in here anywhere, but if this mechanism increases blood volume and blood pressure, is that synergistic or antagonistic to antidiuretic hormone, or doesn't it relate at all? Well, what does ADH do? Increases blood pressure. So what does this mechanism do? increases blood pressure, right? So these things are synergistic to each other. Another way of thinking of this is, what can you tell me about pathology in terms of blood pressure? Is there common pathology relating to blood pressure in our human population here? Yeah. What are you thinking about? What are you thinking of? Okay. I couldn't quite hear that. But in terms of blood pressure in particular, yeah, it can cause heart disease, right? But that high blood pressure, what's another name? Maybe I'm asking the question wrong. What's another name for pathologically high blood pressure? Yeah, hypertension, right? And that will produce cardiovascular disease, heart disease as well, all right? So hypertension is an important problem, all right, in our population. And what have you seen so far in terms of these hormones, namely aldosterone and antidiuretic hormones? Do they promote that disease process, or are these nice hormones that stop that process from happening? No, yeah, they promote that process, right? So we see these two hormones, and so you can kind of understand why hypertension might be a problem in our population, because here you see two important hormones that support or raise blood pressure. So if somebody does have hypertension, we do know that's deadly, and we would like to be able to control, reduce that hypertension, and the way it's done is usually by some kind of regulation with the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. All right, and don't forget, this is the most important one for long-term, so if we can adjust things with this long-term regulation, then somebody's going to have nice normal blood pressure in the long run. So how can we manage hypertension? The first course is with a diuretic. So what does a diuretic do in terms of antidiuretic hormone? It cancels out, right? So instead of antidiuretic hormone increasing blood pressure with a diuretic, then that cancels that effect out. And how does a diuretic work? Well, it reduces blood volume. Think of a balloon, take some air out of it, or your car tire, take air out of the tire. What happens to pressure? It goes down, right? So when you lose fluid through urination, that decreases blood volume, blood pressure goes down. And one of the important ways that happens, when you reduce blood volume, there's less blood going back to the heart, so the heart isn't stretching as much. So what happens to the contractility of the heart when the heart doesn't stretch as much? Does the contractility stay the same, increase or decrease? It decreases because of that Frank-Starling law. That's probably something that's really nice to remember. Okay, another way, and as a matter of fact, we have all of these different things to consider because most people with hypertension, is this a true statement? It might not be a true statement, but let me say it anyway. Most people that have hypertension have difficulty managing hypertension with just one pharmaceutical agent. Usually they have to take a combination of things. Right, because their body tries to reestablish a high blood pressure, because that's what all these systems have a tendency to do. So they might have to take a diuretic and some other kind of medication. And here's another one called an ACE inhibitor. So what does an ACE inhibitor do? Can you see how it interacts on this figure right here? It inhibits the conversion of angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. Again, so it adjusts this whole mechanism, and remember, the point of this whole mechanism is to increase blood pressure, and when it's inhibited with an ACE inhibitor, then that should reduce blood pressure. And indeed, it works pretty well. All right, how else could we adjust the system right here to detune it a little bit? Well, we can also, there are drugs called angiotensin II receptor blockers. Here's angiotensin II, and it has an effect because there are receptors in the adrenal cortex and in arterioles, right, in order for angiotensin II to have an effect, because it's a hormone. But if we block those receptors, then angiotensin II can't exert its effect. So ARBs are things that almost, you could think of them as taking receptors out of your body for angiotensin II, and then angiotensin II can't have an effect if there's no receptors there, right? So ARBs, angiotensin II receptor blockers, another mode of controlling what? Controlling what? Hypertension, high blood pressure. Okay, another way, and that is with beta blockers. Now what is this beta right here referred to? It's not on this diagram at all, but you should know something about beta. Are these cholinergic? That has to do with the cholinergic system or adrenergic system. Yeah. All right, so think of adrenergic receptors, and you know there's alpha and beta. And in particular, what kind does the heart have? They have beta, and what kind? Beta 1, right? And beta 1 is excitatory, causes increased force of contraction because it releases calcium into the sarcomeres of the heart. So if we can block these beta receptors, then the heart will get weaker as a result. So that's another avenue, beta blockers, to just reduce heart activity. It's going to reduce stroke volume, that reduces cardiac output, that reduces blood pressure. Okay. Another thing, a person can use calcium channel blockers. And calcium channel blockers, particularly on the heart, because what does the heart need in order to contract forcefully? It needs calcium, right, flooding around all the myofibrils. So if we block those channels where calcium can leave the sarcoplasmic reticulum, or calcium channels to block calcium from entering the cell, again, we can reduce stroke volume, which reduces blood pressure. So all of these things are marvelous things. And then finally, we haven't talked about alpha-2 agonists. These are adrenergic receptors in the central nervous system, and these are just very powerful kinds of things. One example would be clonidine. And clonidine would be given to somebody, for instance, if their blood pressure, they walked into a hospital and their blood pressure was 200 over 190. What would you immediately be worried about if your blood pressure was 200 over 190 or 150? Yeah, what happens if you put too much air in the balloon? It's going to pop, right? So this person could pop a blood vessel anywhere at any time. And so their blood pressure should be brought down to normal immediately, and this is one of the drugs that can do that. But a person won't feel fine afterwards, right? So you don't do that normally. You usually like to bring it down to normal in steps, slowly, okay? But clonidine can do that very, very rapidly and prevent some of these blood vessels from breaking, for instance. And some people have such difficulty regulating hypertension that even in the long run, they might have to take some clonidine to do that as well. But that's a very powerful kind of drug. All right, so this, what can you tell me about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system? Why do we have it in our bodies? What is it maintaining? It's helping to maintain our blood pressure, right? That's the important thing for this mechanism right here. So you should just be aware of all these different stages. You should know something about angiotensinogen and angiotensin II and how angiotensin II comes about because it's converted from angiotensin I with an enzyme called ACE. And probably you should know what ACE stands for. So this is a really good diagram. Probably you should be able to draw this diagram out. Just have it in your mind. So I'm sure it's an exam figure. Right. I'm sure it's an exam figure, but you don't have to draw it on the exam, but certainly be familiar with it. Okay, here is a website. I think you have an electronic copy of these slides, right, that you can actually go and visit and learn a lot more about how to manage hypertension. And, of course, if somebody does not manage hypertension, it slowly kills most of the cells in their body, sort of like diabetes does. Right, so it slowly kills a person's heart, retina, kidney, so it's very bad all over the system. So bottom line is if you have hypertension or even if you have family members, you have to take it pretty seriously and you've got to help that person manage their blood pressure by consulting with a physician. And like I said, they might go to a physician and say, okay, do I have hypertension? Physician says yes. And they might agree to some kind of therapy and they take it. And usually what happens is that a person, the first time on an antihypertensive agent, actually feels worse than when they have hypertension. So what can you tell me about compliance then, when somebody's taking medication and they feel worse? Well, then you have a tendency not to take it, okay? But that when you don't take it, that's when hypertension slowly kills you, right? So, under those circumstances, be really helpful to that person, get them back to see a doctor and say, hey, you know, maybe this isn't working quite the right way, maybe we got to try a different one, and how many different kinds are there? Many different kinds. Or maybe somebody's taking a diuretic and it doesn't manage their blood pressure, and so they say, oh, well, gee whiz, it didn't work. I'm not even going to be worried about my blood pressure. Well, what's going to happen? They're going to die, right? So support them, get them back to see a doctor again. Maybe some of these other things have to be added. And you know what? It might take a year in order to find the right combination of drugs to keep somebody from being in constant hypertension. So it's a long process. And just be supportive and help them be compliant. And if you really love somebody and they're not being compliant, can you say, you got to take your blood pressure medication because you're going to die if you don't? Can you say that? Well, you could, but what's going to happen to their blood pressure? It's probably going to increase, right? So, I mean, there might come a time where you have to be really frank with somebody, but you have to be sort of careful when you do that. Okay, so renin-angiotensin, aldosterone, most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure. Right, make sure you know that. And is this system synergistic or antagonistic to antidiuretic hormone? Synergistic. So far we just looked at things that raise people's blood pressure. That's probably why it's easy to get hypertension. Okay, last hormone, atrial natriuretic hormone. I like to call it hormone. Your book calls it something a little bit different. And this is released, all right, when blood volume is expanded. And when blood volume is expanded, end diastolic volume goes up. That blood has to go through an atrium first, and as the atrium stretches out, because you have a lot of blood returning to it, that causes the release of atrial natriuretic hormone. So, and that goes into the blood, and it inhibits aldosterone. So now you can see that atrial natriuretic hormone is what? Antagonistic to aldosterone. And because of that, it's going to be antagonistic to antidiuretic hormone. And that also says something about the heart, which maybe you have never considered. What kind of, how do I want to say this? What kind of gland is the heart? Well, you know, yeah, you think of it as a pump, as an organ, but I want you to think of it as a gland. What kind of gland is it? It's an endocrine gland, right? Because it secretes a hormone, namely atrial natriuretic hormone, into the blood, and it binds to the receptors or target tissues in the body that have receptors. So what does it do? It promotes salt and water excretion in the kidney. So there are receptors in the kidney. There are receptors in blood vessels, and it causes alpha-1 receptors, okay, to become inhibited, and that causes vasodilation. So if you take a balloon and stretch it out, what happens to pressure inside the balloon? Not blowing in, but just stretch it out. The pressure decreases. Right? So vasodilation causes a decrease in blood pressure. So going back to that, one more slide. So let's look at a nice feedback loop. All right, so atrial natriuretic hormone, and it works with antidiuretic hormone in a negative feedback loop to lower blood volume. So you might say, how do they work together? Well, because atrial natriuretic hormone decreases antidiuretic hormone secretion. Okay, so here we have water, increased blood volume, or maybe we just have consumed way too much water. That increases blood volume as well, which means more blood is flowing back to the heart. That causes end-diastolic volume to increase, and as end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to the strength of contraction? Yeah, it increases. Frank Starling law. Okay, so we have increased stretch of the left atrium, but the point of atrial natriuretic hormone is to decrease pressure. So if this is already starting an increase, then the heart is going to release atrial natriuretic hormone, and it gets into the blood, goes to the kidney, and it increases salt and water excretion. Right? And so let's follow this track first before we go over here. So if we lose urine, or you use water volume in urine, what happens to blood volume? It goes down, right? And what was the initial stimulus? It was increased blood volume. So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism. Right? So this reduces blood pressure. Okay, and as the stretch receptors measure an increase in filling of the heart, right, the vagus nerve then sends signals to the brain, to the posterior pituitary, because that's just in the central nervous system. Posterior pituitary then decreases the amount of ADH that it secretes. Right, and if you decrease ADH, that allows a diuretic to have more of an effect because there's reduced reabsorption of water in the kidney tubules, that increases urine volume, decreasing blood volume. So atrial natriuretic hormone and antidiuretic hormone work together because the posterior pituitary cuts back on the amount of ADH that is secreted. All right, so ADH doesn't necessarily counteract the effect of atrial natriuretic hormone. All right, so what? How many hormones did we just look at? Well, a whole bunch, but how many main ones did we look at? Yeah, three. Right, so there are some sub-hormones within that renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Right, but here are three. Antidiuretic hormone, what's another name? Vasopressin, aldosterone is one. Okay, and atrial natriuretic hormone from the heart. Which ones are synergistic with each other? ADH and aldosterone, right? And you should remember what's the overall effect, not the mechanism, but what's the overall effect of ADH and aldosterone on, in terms of blood pressure? It raises blood pressure, right? Okay, and what can you tell me about atrial natriuretic hormone in terms of its relationship to ADH and aldosterone? Antagonist, right? So then you should know the effect on blood pressure. It helps decrease blood pressure, all right? But it's kind of overmatched because it's what? Two against one, which is another way maybe you can appreciate how easy it is for somebody to have hypertension, even though it's controlled long-term with these antagonistic mechanisms. Okay. Well, one of the last things we're going to talk about are some things that affect blood flow in your body. So blood pressure is important because what do you know about blood pressure in terms of flow? So our tissues need blood flow, right? That blood flow volume per time is that flow brings in oxygen to tissues, brings in nutrients and washes away toxic compounds like carbon dioxide and other excretory products. So blood pressure is nice, but tissues need blood flow. And what maintains blood flow? This is, you should just memorize this. I put this on the board a couple of times already. Blood flow in a blood vessel or tube is equal to the blood pressure, right? Or you could just say pressure, right? As blood pressure increases, what happens to blood flow? Directly related, right? But that's not the whole story. The whole story is that we also have to consider some resistance in that blood vessel, right? And resistance is what? Inversely related to blood flow. So if resistance increases, blood flow decreases. All right, so those are some of the things that we want to think about. All right, so let's think about that term in the denominator, vascular resistance. All right, so that resistance determines how much blood flows through a tissue and organ, right? And so does blood pressure, but let's keep blood pressure constant. Vasodilation increases resistance, right? Decreases resistance when a blood vessel dilates. This term right here becomes less, which means blood flow increases because of that inverse relationship. Vasoconstriction, on the other hand, does the opposite. Vasoconstriction causes resistance to go up. When this term goes up, what happens to blood flow? It goes down. Okay, so that is a really nice equation you should have in your mind rather than just that balloon analogy, but the balloon analogy is okay. This slide right here is not it's not really important, but you can see that most of the blood is going to the brain, kidneys, right, and skeletal muscles, a little bit to the heart. That's really the only thing that I want you to see on this particular diagram. All right, so here's a slide that basically just shows what we just wrote on the board, and that is blood flow is equal to blood pressure divided by resistance. But what is blood pressure? It's the pressure on either end of a tube. So we want to think of a tube, and we know that there is high pressure in the aorta, and that pressure is used to drive blood through the systemic circulation, and it decreases as it moves through arteries and arterioles, capillaries and veins, and it gets back to the heart at the right atrium, and all of that energy has been used to move the blood over to the right atrium. So the pressure in the right atrium is basically zero. Right? So this term right here, blood pressure, we should actually have pressure 1 from pressure 2, or arterial pressure minus venous pressure. Right? Arterial minus venous pressure, but what is venous pressure or pressure in the right atrium? It is zero. So what is arterial pressure minus zero? What is that equal to? Arterial pressure. So that's why we get away with talking about blood pressure all the time is just one number. But you should remember it's a difference in pressure, but one of the pressures is always going to be a zero. Okay. And this also shows that normal blood pressure is about 120 over 80. And if we take the average of all of that, it's just not the average of these two numbers. In this particular case, it is. The mean is going to be 100 millimeters of mercury. And that's going to be what the average blood flow, that's going to determine average blood flow through a tissue. Okay, so this equation right here works really nice for a blood vessel. All right, so here I'm going to draw a blood vessel. All right, so here's a blood vessel. So the flow through this thing is going to be determined by the pressure on either side divided by the resistance of that blood vessel. Okay, so there is another, here it is right here. So there's another equation that expounds a little bit on this resistance term. What is resistance the result of? Well, it's the result of a number of things. You probably messed around with this in lab. Right, so here we have blood flow equal to pressure divided by resistance. So resistance is this term right here, radius to the fourth power divided by viscosity times the length of that particular blood vessel. That's what we call Poiseuille's law. So if we want to consider blood flow, we got to know something about the diameter of a blood vessel or the radius of a blood vessel, the viscosity of the fluid that's moving through it, and the length of that particular tube. Okay, so as the length of that tube increases, the resistance increases, and so that means blood flow is going to decrease. What about viscosity? As viscosity increases, blood flow decreases. Now, in your body, can you change the length of a blood vessel to regulate blood flow through it? You have a blood vessel going to your gastrocnemius, and you want to regulate blood flow going to that muscle. Maybe you're starting to exercise or something. Can you adjust the length of that blood vessel so that you have more or less blood flow to it, maybe more blood flow? Well, to get more blood flow, you have to shorten that blood vessel. Is there a way to shorten the blood vessel to the gastrocnemius? No way, right? So that is pretty much fixed in our body. Our bodies can't adjust the length of a blood vessel. What about viscosity? Can we change the viscosity of our blood? Okay, maybe a little bit under normal circumstances. Okay, not too much, right? Because we would like to have a constant hematocrit, right? And it's really the number of cells that are in blood that determine the viscosity, and usually that's pretty constant. But if you become dehydrated, severely dehydrated, your hematocrit is going to go way up. You're going to have a lot more red blood cells compared to plasma, and that's going to increase the viscosity of blood, and it's going to be harder for the heart to pump it around. Right? So normally, viscosity, at least in our discussions, we're going to say is pretty much constant, but it could be hugely important if somebody's dehydrated. Okay. And what about radius of a blood vessel? Can that be regulated? And if people are shaking your head, yes, can be regulated very nicely because we have smooth muscle around many, many blood vessels. And those smooth muscles can contract, and that's going to change the radius. As a matter of fact, it's going to decrease the radius of that blood vessel. All right, so what happens to blood flow if the radius decreases? We see it is directly related. When the diameter decreases, blood flow decreases because resistance goes way up, right? Here's that resistance term. But what is really amazing about Poiseuille's law? If we change resistance maybe by a factor of two, does blood flow change by a factor of two? And the answer is no, because of the fourth power of the radius right here, the fourth power rule. So if the radius changes by a factor of two, blood flow is going to change by a factor of what?
2 times 2 times 2.
I'm still not even done, right? Times 2. Now am I done? Now am I done? Yeah. And what's that? 4, 8, 16. Okay. So small changes in radius make a large change in blood flow through an organ, and that's how blood flow is regulated in most parts of our body, just by causing more or less vasoconstriction or more or less vasodilation. So that's Poiseuille's law. But that's just a takeoff of this equation right here. And what kind of system are we thinking about when we use Poiseuille's law? What kind of chamber, what kind of vessel are we thinking about? We're thinking about a blood vessel right here. Talking about blood vessel, right? So this equation is great for blood vessel. Okay, so this is a plot of blood pressure versus the various kinds of blood vessels that we have in our body. The most proximal, right, are going to be large arteries, and then blood's going to flow into smaller ones, and capillaries, venules, and large veins. And of course, that all comes from the left ventricle, because the left ventricle contracts and produces about 120 millimeters of mercury pressure on that blood. And so when you look at this chart, what blood vessel has the lowest pressure? All right, so don't forget, you got arteries, you got capillaries, and you've got veins. What's the function of a capillary once again? Exchange, yeah, it's very important because of exchange. Now, which one of these blood vessels has the lowest blood pressure by looking at this chart right here? Okay, I didn't hear any wrong answers. That's nice. I used to hear a lot of wrong answers. I used to hear, maybe you were thinking of this, but just didn't say it out loud. Okay, a lot of people think capillaries because that's one of the most significant, right, parts of the cardiovascular system, because that's where exchange takes place. But that's not where we have the lowest pressure, because if capillaries had the lowest pressure compared to veins or arteries, where would all the blood flow to? Would flow into capillaries, from veins into capillaries, or from arteries into capillaries. Well, that does not happen, right? We want blood to flow back to the heart, so the lowest blood pressure is in large veins that are close to the heart, so blood flows back to the heart, right? So blood is going to flow from high pressure to low, so veins have to have the lowest pressure to get blood back to the heart. And now, what about that capillary? We said it's important for exchange, all right? So here is centimeters squared. This is a surface area, right? It's just a diameter. It's the area of a circle of a blood vessel, right? Like we measured the surface area of that door. That was easy because it's not a circle, right? We just measure the height times the width to get the surface area. You'd have to use a little bit different equation to figure out what the surface area of a circle is, but it's not really much more difficult. And if we were just to measure empirically, we see that the aorta has kind of a relatively small surface area. The aorta is large, right? But compared to the surface area of all other, or the cross-sectional area of all other vessels, we see that is actually pretty small. Because if we have a little bit larger vessel, right, it's going to be smaller in diameter, but you have more of them. So if you add that all together, you get a bigger cross-sectional area. Arterioles, the cross-sectional area or surface area that blood goes through, is smaller still, but you have what? Many, many, many more arterioles, thousands more arterioles than you do have arteries. So if we add all that up together, then the cross-sectional area is even higher. And what is the vessel system that has the highest cross-sectional area? Yeah, it's a capillary, right? They're the smallest in diameter, but you have so many of them that if you add that all together, that gives us the largest cross-sectional area, and then the cross-sectional area starts to decrease again when blood goes into venules, veins, and finally vena cava. All right, so the cross-sectional area of capillaries is the largest. That has an effect on the speed of blood. And what is centimeters per second? Very similar to miles per hour. What is miles per hour? That's a speed, right? So the faster your speed is, the faster you can get someplace, right? The slower the speed, then it takes longer to get someplace. So let's look at speed. Here is a plot of speed versus these same blood vessels, arteries, capillaries, and veins. Okay. And in what kind of blood vessel is the speed the slowest? Look at this. Here's capillaries. And it's just a physical law. As we have a certain amount of the amount of blood is fixed, as we increase the cross-sectional area of a tube, the flow has to slow down. Right? And if we decrease the cross-sectional area, the flow starts to speed up once again. That's just a physical property. All right, now why is that a good thing? Because what's happening in capillaries? Exchange. And so if blood was speeding through a capillary, then there would not be time for exchange. But because you have so many capillaries, right, that is the place where you have the slowest flow, and that allows for a lot of exchange to take place. All right, so this is a pretty interesting graph to look at. So that's a nice one. Yeah.
So as you decrease the
cross section. Okay. The velocity increases as you decrease. So we're thinking, what's a good way to think about this? Think about a certain volume of blood, like a volume of blood like my fist right here. It's moving through a tube, okay, and my fist can fit into a tube. It's moving at a certain velocity, right, and we have a tube over here. Blood is moving through the tube at a certain velocity, that same volume of blood, right, but then if it gets into a capillary where the surface area, where the cross-sectional area gets very big, we have that same volume of blood, but now what does it do? It has to expand, so that velocity has to decrease in that area of a capillary. I don't know if I can explain it very intuitively. Cross-section is this thing right here. Here we have a blood vessel. If we turn it on end, we're going to find something like this, right? And this is the cross-sectional area. Here is the radius. So this cross-sectional area is what? I forget what it is. 2/3 pi r squared, something like that. So this is the cross-sectional area. Okay, so here's the aorta, right? Here's a cross-section of the aorta. And let's draw a cross-section of a capillary. This is what? Really small, microscopic, right? So the cross-sectional area of the aorta is huge compared to this. But how many capillaries do you have? Millions. I couldn't even draw them in by the time the semester's over, right? So what happens to the cross-sectional area now? Okay, if we add all those small things up together, you get something with a larger cross-sectional area. I'll just kind of diagram it like this, right? Okay, so if the same amount of blood is flowing in to this cross-sectional area, it has to slow down compared to when it's compressed into a smaller diameter tube, or a tube that has a smaller radius. Okay, yeah, so just think of all those capillaries, you have to add them all together. All right, blood pressure. Well, we said blood pressure is regulated in your body. It's used to regulate flow through various tissues by vasoconstriction. So here is a little thought experiment that we can do. If we maintain pressure in this tube by keep adding blood to it, right, if we increase the height of the blood, then the pressure is going to increase because gravity is pulling down on it. And if this fluid can flow through this tube into another vertical tube and another one and then another one, three of them all together, right, then without any kind of constriction in these tubes, well, the highest pressure is going to be in the first tube, a little bit lower pressure in the next one, and then a little bit lower pressure in the third one. But if we want to increase pressure in these two tubes while decreasing pressure in this third one right here, then we can introduce a little resistance by, what's the favorite method of increasing resistance in your body? Vasoconstriction. Let's increase some resistance right here. So we're going to have reduced flow. Okay, so we have reduced flow that's going to cause a decrease in blood pressure because they're just directly related to each other, but that's going to increase blood pressure in these two other systems over here. So this is how blood pressure is regulated and blood flow is regulated in all the different parts of your body because you don't have enough blood in your body to go everywhere at one time. Your body has to pick where it goes. Right? Even if we were to constrict all of those veins, you still wouldn't have enough blood to go to all those capillary beds everywhere in your body. So here we have plot of that cross-sectional area once again, highest in capillaries. And because these arterioles right here have relatively low cross-sectional area. right, compared to capillaries. This is where the cross-sectional area changes the most. This is where we have the highest resistance. And since this is the area where we have the highest resistance, that's where we see the biggest drop in pressure. So the biggest drop in pressure that we see in arteries and veins is through arterioles and capillaries. And then once blood gets into venules and veins, the blood pressure stays pretty much the same. Pressure stays pretty much the same in large arteries and small arteries. It's only when the cross-sectional area starts to increase does the pressure decrease because of resistance. So blood pressure, what is it due to? It's due to three main things. It's due to heart rate, stroke volume, and the resistance of blood vessels. If we were to add all the blood vessel resistance together, then we call that peripheral resistance or total peripheral resistance. And we call that TPR. Now, so we could write an equation. We could say, because of this statement right here, blood pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times the resistance. Well, to me, that is, it's not counterintuitive, but it's certainly not intuitive. I just don't see why that is so. But I would like for you to see why that is so. All right, I want you to become a little bit more familiar with that. Why is blood pressure equal to stroke volume times heart rate times total peripheral resistance? All right, so I'm going to erase this to the fourth power rule right here. So here is blood flow through a blood vessel. What is blood flow instead of a blood vessel? Instead of a blood vessel, what is blood flow through the heart? What is that equal to? That's equal to cardiac output. That's how much blood the heart is pumping, right? All right, so that's cardiac output. But what is cardiac output equal to? I've been writing that down for a couple of days. That's equal to what? Stroke volume, the amount of blood the heart pumps every time it contracts, times how often it contracts, which is heart rate. Okay, and we also know that the amount of blood that the heart pumps has to equal the amount of blood that flows through a blood vessel. Otherwise, it's going to build up someplace. If there's more blood flow through a blood vessel, then the heart is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and finally explode. Right? So blood flow through this, all the blood vessels has to equal blood flow through the heart. That's just the way it goes. So what do we have? Cardiac output is what? mLs per minute. Let's say volume per time. What's blood flow? Volume per time, right? So it's the same units, blood flow. So guess what we can do? Oh, wow, these things are equal to each other, I just said, right? So we got blood pressure divided by resistance is equal to stroke volume times heart rate. Well, that's really nice, because now I'm beginning to see why blood pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times resistance. Because what can we do over here? We can multiply this thing by R. We can multiply the left side by R. As long as we do what? Multiply the right side of the equation by R. And then these R's over here go away. And what are you left with? Blood pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times resistance. I'm just going to put total peripheral resistance right here. So if there is an increase in resistance in a blood vessel, what happens to blood pressure across that blood vessel from one end to the other? Pressure increases. Okay, if stroke volume of the heart gets stronger, blood pressure increases. Or if the heart starts to beat faster, even though it doesn't beat any stronger, blood pressure is still going to increase. All right, so an increase in any one of these will increase blood pressure. A decrease in any one of these will decrease blood pressure. So maybe you could just memorize this equation right here. But if that's really difficult, right, it's easier to memorize blood pressure divided by resistance, stroke volume times heart rate, right, are equal to each other, and just go ahead and derive that. Right, but this is going to be an important equation for you to think about how your body maintains blood pressure. And we've kind of used it already. sympathoadrenal activity, which is what? The release of epinephrine and norepinephrine from the adrenal medulla causes vasoconstriction, and it causes the heart to beat faster and more strongly. Right? So what's the effect of sympathetic release from the adrenal medulla on blood pressure? What did we say? We said vasoconstriction. So if there's vasoconstriction, what happens to resistance? As it constricts, that means more resistance. What's the effect of that on blood pressure? Increased blood pressure. All right? Sympathetic stimulation on the heart is that going to decrease heart rate or increase? Increase. So if that increases heart rate, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up too. All right? And adrenaline on the heart causes the force of contraction to get stronger. All right? So stroke volume goes up. Stroke volume goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It increases, right? So an increase in any one of these causes an increase in blood pressure. So that's a particularly handy equation, and we've actually been using that already today quite a bit. Okay, and so here, the kidneys play a really important role in maintaining blood pressure, the kidneys of all things, because the kidneys regulate blood volume by producing more or less urine. And when you regulate blood volume, because end-diastolic volume changes, right? If we retain fluids, end-diastolic volume increases. Frank Starling's law of the heart says force of contraction is going to increase. If force of contraction increases, what happens to stroke volume? It increases, right? So the kidneys have a role, major role, in adjusting blood pressure because it interacts with stroke volume of the heart via that end-diastolic volume mechanism. All right, so that's a really, really handy equation. I would recommend that you actually learn how to derive it. And in Blackboard, I do have a little webinar archive for you where I derive that. So you can go and look at that again, because I don't know if it will make sense to you maybe a half hour after the class is over, even though it's pretty amazing to look at right now. Okay. All right, so we're still talking about blood pressure. Here is another mechanism. We call this the baroreceptor reflex. And the baroreceptor reflex is the most important mechanism for maintaining or regulating blood pressure. But we said the most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure was the renin-angiotensin mechanism. But in what realm did the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism work? Long term. All right? But you might have to make some serious adjustments to your blood pressure rapidly over a period of a second, and that's where the nervous system comes in particular the baroreceptor reflex. So baroreceptor reflex is the most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure from second to second, right, in the short term. And that has to work together, of course, with the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. All right, so baroreceptor reflex is activated by changes in blood pressure. There are pressure receptors in the aortic bodies and carotid bodies, and the aortic bodies are in the aortic arch. The carotid bodies are, does anybody know where the carotid sinus is? Maybe. Some anatomy books do a really lousy job of telling you about this place. But you have the common carotid, and it gets up into your neck, and it bifurcates, right? What does it bifurcate into? Internal and external carotid. Right at that bifurcation is where the carotid sinus is. So the carotid sinus is right here. They're important pressure receptors. When the blood pressure increases, the artery stretches a little bit, so those pressure receptors really are stretch receptors. And then it sends signals to the brain, and that's in the medulla. That's where the cardioregulatory and vasomotor center is. So your medulla really knows what your blood pressure is from second to second at any particular moment because the baroreceptors are sending signals there. Increase in blood pressure causes the walls of those blood vessels to stretch. That increases the frequency of action potentials to the medulla, in particular that the cardioregulatory center, vasomotor center. All right, and so guess what you have in the vasomotor center and cardioregulatory center? Your book calls it cardiac control center. It is a set point, right? So these, how would we want to consider these centers right here? What do you know has a set point? The integration center. So these centers in the medulla is the integration center, so it takes in this information from the baroreceptors, compares it to what the set point should be, and if they are different, if those numbers are different, then the medulla has to make a decision on what to do, right? To increase your blood pressure if your blood pressure is decreasing, or decrease your blood pressure if your blood pressure is increasing to maintain homeostasis. Right, and this, the baroreceptor, is, like I said, most sensitive to sudden changes in blood pressure, and especially a decrease in pressure. Because if there's a sudden decrease in pressure, what happens to blood flow to the brain? If there's a decrease in blood pressure, what happens to blood flow to the brain? Because it's going through this tube right here. Yeah, it decreases, right? Because they're directly related. But your brain needs a lot of oxygen all the time to maintain consciousness. So if that blood pressure decreases, you might actually faint. You might lose consciousness as a result. Does anybody know what that's called when you faint? Starts with an S. Maybe that's called syncope. Yeah, syncope. Okay. All right, so here is that baroreceptor reflex. Here are the aortic bodies in the arch of the aorta. Here's that nice carotid sinus. There are carotid bodies here that can monitor blood pressure. And it's sending signals into the vasomotor center. Where's that vasomotor center at? Medulla, we see it right here. And what does it have to compare with the pressure that it's getting information from in the carotid sinus and aortic arch? It has a set point, compares the two. Right? And then if they're different, it's got to make a decision. And the decisions could be to either speed up the heart, okay? It could speed up the heart, increasing heart rate, right? If the pressure is low, it could speed up the heart rate to increase pressure, could speed up or could increase the force of contraction, right? And that will increase blood pressure. And it can even increase by vasoconstricting blood vessels. It can increase total peripheral resistance by sending information out to various places. And on this slide, we see only information only going to the heart, but not blood vessels. But you can imagine. We'll talk about that last. All right. So let's just say there's a decrease in blood pressure. All right, and that information is sent to the cardioregulatory center, and the cardioregulatory center says, "Oh, decrease in blood pressure. What's way to get blood pressure back up? Let's send a signal to the heart to do what?" We have sympathetic, right? Here's the sympathetic outflow pathway, which is, how do you think of sympathetic outflow? It is what? Thoracolumbar, so it's got to leave the spinal cord, right? It's not through a cranial nerve, so it leaves the spinal cord, passes through the sympathetic chain ganglia. Well, actually, it doesn't pass through, but it synapses in the sympathetic chain ganglion, and then there's a sympathetic cardiac nerve that goes to the atrium as well as the ventricle. Sympathetic tone, an increase in sympathetic tone on the SA node will increase the heart rate. If the heart rate increases, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up. All right. That sympathetic nerve also goes to the myocardial ventricle, and it causes increased force of contraction. Which, how does that affect this equation right here? Force of contraction gets stronger. Which one of these terms? Stroke volume. Stroke volume goes up, what happens to blood pressure? Yeah. And what was that compared to the initial stimulus? We said the initial stimulus was a decrease in blood pressure. All right, so that's a nice homeostatic mechanism. What you don't see on this slide is that the sympathetic nerve also goes to blood vessels, like arterioles, right? And can you tell me on those arterioles, okay, it's going to adjust resistance. And what is it going to do to arterioles? Is it going to cause vasodilation or vasoconstriction to increase blood pressure? It's going to cause vasoconstriction that increases resistance. If this increases, then blood pressure increases as well. Okay, so this baroreceptor reflex is going to operate in you as soon as we're done in class, which is just mere moments, right? Because you're sitting, you've been relaxed now for a couple hours, just listening to lecture. You're going to stand up. You're going to change body position. All right? And when that happens, blood is going to pool in your extremities. There's less blood flowing back to the heart. And the heart, what happens when less blood is going back to the heart? And diastolic volume goes down. What happens to force of contraction? It gets weaker. All right? So as soon as you stand up, your heart gets weaker. Stroke volume goes down. What happens to blood pressure? It's going to start to drop. All right, but that's not such a big deal in most people. You don't have to worry about fainting because you have baroreceptors in the carotid sinus, an arch. It's going to measure a decrease, send it to the vasomotor center. Vasomotor center, right after you stand up or after you take a step, it's going to increase stroke volume and heart rate. Your heart rate's going to increase when you stand up. What you don't feel is a change in your resistance right here, but that will go up momentarily. So as soon as you stand up, you might feel a little bit faint, okay? But because of the baroreceptor reflex, your blood pressure is going to come right back to normal, and you'll be able to go to work or go home or whatever. All right, people that where this baroreceptor reflex is not working, when they stand up, guess what happens to them? They faint, yeah, when they change body position. We call that orthostatic hypotension, when their blood pressure goes way down too much. And that might be because there's a mismatch maybe in their hypertensive medication or something like that. Maybe they have too much regulation on their blood pressure medication. Don't know. But does anybody ever feel like that when they stand up in here? Do you feel a little bit like fainting when you stand up? Maybe just a little bit. Probably women are more susceptible because their blood pressure is lower normally compared to males, typically. But it's really not a problem unless you pass out when you're driving down on the 405 freeway. Then that's not a good thing, right? If you get a little dizzy as you stand up, that's probably not a bad thing. The lower your blood pressure is, the more your heart and blood vessels are protected, right? So women that have really low blood pressure probably won't have any cardiovascular disease. That's really nice. But it can't be so low that you pass out when you change body position. All right, so sinus sheet is going around. I think I have one more slide. I don't want to talk about this today, but when we talk about it next time, this will just recapitulate everything that we've talked about today. So look over it sometime before break. The other slide that you should really pay attention to, maybe even for the rest of your life, is this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism right here. Should be able to draw that out. What's the significance of that renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system? It regulates blood pressure in the long term. Okay, thank you.